and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 639.
639.
And luckily I reread the issue, so at least it has some bearing on me.
Yeah. Oh, man. We're getting into Core again, which might be the best Green Lantern book we've got.
I don't know why we keep saying it might be. It's by far the best Green Lantern book we have at the moment. And at least it's the one book where something happens in it.
That's very, very true. Do you want to get into it?
Yeah, I reckon so. Let me make sure I got this sucker ready. So it's this is Green Lantern Core 14, otherwise known as Green Guy Gardner Born Again. So part one. Oh, God. Or DC KO ordained. Oh, God. These people need a life. We kind of pick up where we left off in a way, even though obviously a lot of information has changed hands from the last time we saw a guy being startled awake by a bunch of babbling entity babies. So now I guess he's the All Sight, which I guess is still, it sounds a little better than Emerald Sight, I suppose. And it's not Simon, so that's a plus right there. But he has his own temple. I guess that's something.
So then now he built a church and put stained glass windows of him as warrior in there.
I know. Well, probably Guy did, but or he gave them instructions. It's like, build this. Build it, they will come. So yes, in the meantime, all of a sudden now there's like a cult of worship that has grown quickly around Guy Gardner, because Guy Gardner has the magical ability to hear the entities, the baby entities who are talking to him. And all the stuff. And this book also continues the bad pattern of, though it's a good book overall, it continues the bad pattern that we've gotten a lot, which is the telling, not showing. So now supposedly Guy Gardner at some point found out that in the Book of Oa, it talks about how the entities are reborn as babies. Every time they die, they're reborn, which is a really interesting fact that would have been beneficial when everybody was crying and well, not everybody. Most people didn't act like they gave a shit, to be honest with you. Let me walk that back. But it would have been beneficial to know that when we thought the entities died fighting the Starbreakers, that the fact that, hey, guess what? Them dying isn't a big deal, because it's like a recharge button. It automatically reboots a game that reboots. They don't make it crystal clear, by the way, whether Guy learned this after he started getting the All Sight, or whether they kind of hint almost it was when he was being obsessed with reading the Book of Oa, which is even more of an excuse not to tell people. Oh, by the way. So you have Narf, right? Narf comes to go get him because Jessica Cruz is demanding his, requesting his presence. And now we see all his quote-unquote disciples kneeling before Guy Gardner. And this is a hodgepodge. Just talk about an eclectic group. Some of these make sense, and some of these make no sense. You got St. Walker, who makes sense, even though having him be like the only one we visibly see 100% kissing the ground is it's in character, but as we see the story play out, it almost makes it sound like he's a little too much of a fanatic to be trusted to go along with Guy, which I reject. You have Arkillo, who I only buy because we know his planet had some form of religion anyway, and he is close to Guy. So I could buy that. Natromo only because of the fact that we know that this issue is all about proselyte. And maybe surprisingly, maybe not, considering the Indigo tribe is all about compassion. They are mostly all about themselves, too. So that would make sense, since the primary mission seems to be to find proselyte first. So Natromo would be on board with this. I'm really not buying Dexstar, though I guess it's better than Atrocitus. And I ain't buying Salak at all. If there's one person who is not going to be kneeling from a religious perspective, probably in front of anyone, let alone Guy Gardner, it's not going to be Salak. But all these people, I like when Guy Gardner goes, "Yes, my son," talking to Nar. It's like Guy walks the line between believing his own shit and completely just, it's like he's playing a role. It's like he can't really decide. Maybe it's a duality of him. So he gets rid of all his disciples temporarily so Narf and him can have a conversation. And Narf explains, well, Jessica really wants to see him mostly because, hey, you can contact the emotional entities and they think that's important because you have again, hodgepodge stuff that you really have no proof of at the time. That Jessica believes that part of the reason why Guy has this power is because of the alpha power from a DCKO. That basically every champion was touched by the power. So there's a deeper meaning and a connection to the universe. And she kind of assumes this means that this is almost like Guy's higher purpose is to help find the entities, or help them find the entities before somebody bad can find the entities and misuse them. And the guy is real willing to go along with this just because he wants to get all their voices out of their heads. Now, as Chad was subtly alluding to, in the meantime, as all this is going on, and it'd be really annoying that Proselyte just keeps speaking in Guy's head 3601. 3601. which, yes, refers to Sector 3601. That's the what? The Lost Sector? Is that the Lost Sector?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Either way, now we cut to something which I guess we were waiting for, though it's not overly satisfying, really. John's conversation with Cat Matui, and John's trying to get her to open up. And she kind of goes off on him a little bit. It's like, hey, running off the laundry list of things that have happened since she came back and how she's been treated. And she just doesn't, and this just isn't really working for her like this. And she just says, I really want to go to Korrigor. She really wants to go to be around her own people. And John says, yeah, I don't have any problem taking you there. Once Guy goes to see Jessica and Joe, because I guess Joe's got nothing better to do, I suppose, at the moment, that Guy's willing to put together a team, and this is when she elaborates because of all the alpha energy that he has, and like I said, the universe is basically trying to balance the power, and they want us to kind of like to find the entities and bring them home and everything. You know, the entities everybody was willing to flip the bird to like 5 issues ago, mostly Hal, but everybody was on board with it. Now it's like, oh, we need them. Just like the beginning of the book is like, you know, Guy rehashing what has happened. You know, we lost the source of our power, Ion. It's like, okay, whatever, dude. So they put together a team, and the team basically will consist, as we'll find out, of people who Guy wants them because he believes they're not going to get caught up in the fervor of bowing at his feet, ironically, that they're people who are a little more level-headed. So we'll see him meet the team in a second. We cut to Korrigor, where there's a Bokra, which is like a street fighting contest, and Terrorfist, what a great name. This is where the Hulk Hogan Macho Man knockoff should have been, when you think about it. He would have had a purpose here. No one can stop Terrorfist, except somebody can, and it's Sorenik now, too. Why Sorenik is able to beat this guy? Well, we'll come back to this in a second. Now, the team is put together, so we have Razor and Aya, because of course we do. We have Fatality. And the Trobone's going along for the ride, probably going along mostly because they're trying to retrieve their own entity. Sinestro is, I'm not quite sure why Sinestro is willing to go along with this. Ellie is requested, of course she is, to be the Blue Lantern representative. And Lorfleet, I guess because he's literally the only Orange Lantern. And, you know, Lorfleet's the one who was destroying Owl like a couple of issues ago, and they gave him a friggin' chair and it made him happy. Now apparently just a request is able to eventually make him join the team. And they decide to go to Sector 3601, though it is Manhunter territory, to try to find Proselyte. And Fatality uses a power to be able to, you know, her power to the Indigo power to be able to teleport. So she teleports them there, hoping it's going to prevent them from being detected almost immediately by the Manhunters. On New Korrigor, Sorenik fights this Terrorfist guy and just breaks his arm and destroys him. And John somehow was able to pick up on because of his ring. Now, if it was because of his own power, I would buy it more. But somehow the ring's now able to pick up on emotional entity energy, which is different. So he automatically jumps to the conclusion that, hey, I think she might be possessed by Parallax, which, of course, is correct. And Parallax apparently is weak, but he's there trying to reinstill fear on Korugor because they've kind of lost it. And John talks to Sora Parallax and says, hey, you know, why don't you give her a break and why don't you come into me and let's deal with the stuff together. And he goes, hey, that sounds like a good deal, because of course he's an enhanced being. Why wouldn't it sound like a good deal to Parallax? So Parallax goes into John. I'm not really quite sure what this new look of his is going to really look like, because it's kind of half-assed on this page, other than all the energy swirling around him. Sora and Katma look pretty good on the background too, staring up at John. And Parallax talks about, you're right, this merger might work out because you've got much more fear and grief to feed off of. The guy and company arrive in Sector 3601. They're expecting to find a lot more destruction, I believe, but they don't find that. And Guy, Razor, and Tality, they go off to explore why everybody else is supposed to stay behind. Fatality starts picking up on unfiltered raw compassion is all around them, which if it's just coming from Prozolite, then something seems off because he doesn't seem weak. And then all of a sudden, the three of them can't move. They're surrounded by Manhunters. And we find out that, hey, the Manhunters are somehow feeding off of the energy of compassion. And next issue, where the merciless Manhunters bleed compassion dry.
Just going to get it over with real quick, because we don't need to harp on it real quick. I am so sick of people drawing Larfleeze to have a flat face. I hate that interpretation of Larfleeze, especially on this cover. It looks awful. He looks zany. He looks ridiculous. Larfleeze has a long snout. See, I don't know, the upcoming McFarlane figure. He doesn't look like this. Okay? Can we please?
Yeah, I think we know the answer to that. But yes, for the love of... Please, baby Jesus, help us a little bit here.
Yeah. Also, don't remember people worshiping the entities. I feel like... maybe Atrocitus in the Red Lantern Corps because of just the sheer power, but he was trying to harness the Butcher. He was trying to get the Butcher reborn but it felt like more like Atrocitus in the Corps realized how important the entity was power wise, or, you know, just to have in their possession and so on, like an asset as opposed to a being to be worshipped. Maybe the Blue Lanterns, but I don't know. I never really felt like anybody was worshiping the entities. Hell, when they went beyond the source wall, the team that went beyond the source wall, none of them gave a shit. They were like, yeah, we're okay with Hal's plan to, like,
I know,
say screw you to the entities.
Yeah,
essentially.
This is too much of a 180 real quick. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, they were all, like you said, they were all, which we pointed out, never made a whole lot of sense anyway. It's like, yeah, we're wiping our, like, again, the great Jeremy Adams pep talk stuff. It's like, hey, you're gonna help us do our job, and then we're gonna flip you the bird and send you away, and that's the reason why you should go along with our plan. It made no sense. They were perfectly happy letting the entities go out there, wander off on their own, and then all of a sudden now it's like, oh my god, now we have to find them and bring them home. Besides, the one thing I didn't mention, I mentioned another episode. They reiterated the fact that there's only six batteries on OA, which we damn well know there were seven because we literally saw them. Now, they might mean only six were lit, even though, again, in the issue where they all were lit up, they all did light technically too. But they're going to keep trying to pretend that they didn't put the seventh battery on OA until people forget, I guess, that they did. But, yeah, I mean, I can see it with the Indigos, because, surprisingly, in a way, maybe even more than the Red Lanterns, that the Indigos seem, like I mentioned earlier this episode, the Indigos are extremely self-serving. So they may see getting Prozolite first and foremost literally is most important to them, because of the fact that at any given time, if they have Prozolite, even if they have to leave, they got Natromo, so he can always build another power battery. So once you got your entity back, you can always say, hey, the minute things start getting dicey, we're going to leave. we're going to leave Oa and Goa separate ways. Kind of like they were hanging out in the cave when Lord Fleece was decimating the planet until they saw an opening where it could be beneficial. So I think it works a little bit with the Indigo tribe. But I think generally speaking, yeah, I don't think any of the cores, I'm trying to think about this. I don't think any of the cores have ever shown any real kneeling before Adara, with the exception of, as you said, probably conceptually with Adara, even though we've barely seen her.
Yeah, when the entities showed up, especially I'm talking like brightest day, because there was that search for various entities, like how we got introduced to Adara. Not necessarily as a concept, because we saw her in that splash page during Blackest Night, but I'm talking about just like afterwards when they're like the search for the entities was on, essentially because Krona was collecting them.
Yep.
There was always this sense of like, you know, double splash pages and just this sense of awe and, you know, them influencing everybody in their immediate vicinity with whatever, you know, emotion they are particularly in charge of eliciting or whatever. So there was that. So there's something to be admired and awed at about the raw power of nature in this. But they weren't like worshipped as in. And then you get to the idea of who's kneeling in front of him. Saint Walker doesn't make sense, especially kissing the floor, because he may be the quote unquote more fanatical one or whatever. But he wouldn't be kissing the floor. He'd be meditating, sitting next to Guy, trying to get a sense of what to do next.
I agree with you.
Arkillo. He may have a respect for Guy, but nobody in the Sinestro Corps, as far as we know, ever had any, worshipful reaction to Parallax, because Sinestro himself treated Parallax like a thing for him to be used. Like he was, I'm trying to think back to Sinestro Corps War, which has been a while since I've read that. I don't remember. I just remember like he was just a more powerful member of the Sinestro Corps, essentially a thing to be thrown into Kyle or, you know, whatever, and just have on his side or be used by him. It was never anything. So I Sinestro's right hand man, so to speak. I don't think he would have much of a different viewpoint. And yes, he earned a respect for Guy, but I don't think that would lead to the next step logically being worship. Dexstar was on the side of Atrocitus when Guy got, you know, kicked Atrocitus out of the Red Lantern Corps, and Dexstar is fiercely loyal to Atrocitus, and there is zero way he would take the side, quote unquote, of Guy to the point where he's kneeling in front of him. Salik makes zero sense, just because Salik, first of all, I don't even think Salik is religious. His species might be. It's been a long, long time since we've read anything focused on Salik, like back when we first got a book called Core, when Green Lantern suddenly, like around issue 200 or something, became Green Lantern Core for, like, I don't know, was that like 20 or 30 issues before that run ended? But that back in the 80s. So Salik makes zero sense because, first of all, anytime Guy spoke in Salik's presence, he hated it. He does not like Guy Gardner. Historically speaking, he's been on a team with him, I think, but does not like him. The only one that makes sense is Natromo, but it just feels because of their dedication to finding proselyte and... they've been talking about it since we've seen Natromo show up in the story again. He's hyper-focused on it, so I don't even see his bowing as sincere, just more of like a means to an end.
I guess the only thing you could try to believe in this is that what's going on, either because of the power emanating from Guy himself, or because Guy, in a way, because the entities are around Guy, either way, a connection to the spectrum for them, or maybe just when they're around Guy, period, now, is so magnified that it's almost like a wave of emotion that they're not doing that. It's not very voluntary, really. I mean, they may think they're doing it voluntarily, but they're kind of overcome by emotion. But generally speaking, you're correct. Now, by the way, one could make a strong case that, with the exception of, you throw Fatality in this mix, to the same group that we saw in this opening splash page, and have Fatality in here, and have Natromo tag along like he did anyway, because he was just technically, he wasn't supposed to be part of the group. the original selected group, this would be a more interesting group to watch in action, though. Not just because you'd have Arkillo and St. Walker working side by side again, but, I mean, you rarely get to see Salak. Even if they brought Narf, it would be cool. And Dexter, I mean, you very rarely ever see Dexter outside of, you know, like you said, working side by side with Atrocitus. So one could make a strong case. This would be the more interesting group to follow if they were going to go off on this side mission. But you know, you got to check the boxes. So you got to put in Ellie, and you got to put in Joe. And now you got to put in Razor and Aya, even though they have been served. They really have done absolutely nothing with these characters to make you really care that they're here for the most part. And Sinestro, I guess, and again, you can make a strong case that makes no sense whatsoever that Sinestro's there.
Yeah.
The only thing that would make sense if Sinestro's there is that if this group is going to be the one that encounters Parallax soon. And then it would be interesting because obviously the last time those two characters met, they certainly were not on good terms. So
they also just reintroduced Sora. So like he has to be a part of the main story right now because we need him to have a reaction on panel when Sora shows up. And
that depends chronologically where things go. If John ends up back on Oa. He arguably might take Sora with him, which would mean if Sinestro was on Oa, he would see Sora too. Mm-hmm. But it is probably the double whammy, but that's also working under the belief, which I don't remember even by the solicits, if they end up on New Korrigor after, or if the John Parallax combination end up seeking them out, which is possible too. If Parallax is controlling John long enough, he may try to use John as a vessel to go after Sinestro. But other than the Parallax thing, Arkillo would have been the more logical Yellow Lantern to go, especially because he is close to Guy. So
the other piece I would say is another person worshiping Guy's every step that makes zero sense when he walks into the meeting. Zelias is behind him, literally laying out a red carpet. Zelias Zox.
Yeah.
A prophet's feet should never touch the ground.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Of all people, he was the one talking about that too. Yeah, I think we almost have to say that something because of the alpha energy, which again is a real convenient explanation for all of this. A lot of this is just real convenient that we have to assume it's the alpha. The alpha energy is what's causing the reaction of people around them. Kind of just like we saw how Larfleeze going wild on the surface of Oa was having everybody overcome with greed. It's similar. It's got to be something similar to that, except arguably even worse because Guy's tapping into all the entities and the fact that he's got the extra alpha energy too. So that's what I think we have to assume. I don't think this is. It's the only thing that has even a breadcrumb of sense to it. The fact that they're responding because of not voluntarily, just because it's almost like they're brainwashed, but on an emotional level, they're emotionally washed to just do what they're doing.
Yeah. As far as the John Katma conversation, I said we need this conversation. I did. So we got it. So yay. Also though, it only took a page.
Yep.
A very wordy page, but a single page to have that conversation. It feels like they did it to get it over with.
I agree.
Like
you said, it was like we all knew it was something that had to happen in some way, shape, or form. So let's just pull the Band-Aid off so we can move on.
Yeah. I mean, it gets us to Korrigar, so whatever. But it's better than not having the conversation, but it wasn't very satisfying. Also, I just noticed in the page where Guy is walking in, Joe is building a Gundam out of a construct Gundam.
Yeah, I was trying to
in pieces, and she's putting it together like a model kit.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what exactly she was doing. I knew she was playing with a construct toy. I just couldn't quite figure out what it was.
Yeah, better art now on the baby entities. They look. They definitely look more like, you know, chibi anime type designs, but like Ophidian's head doesn't look crazy. You know, I think Adara looks pretty cute. The tiny calf instead of being the butcher. I think Predator looks strange, but just because a chibi version of Predator, just Predator in general's design is weird. So making it chibified is probably even stranger.
They're all halfway decent except for Timu Parallax, which also creates another problem. This automatic reboot thing when it comes to the entity. So trying to reconcile that with the concept that, again, if somebody really thought Parallax was dead, then, you know, again, I guess apparently only Guy was the one who has ever read the book of, spent time reading the book of Owai. You know, as opposed to all those other facts people have spouted out in these two series that they would have, by all rights, no logical reason to know about. Hey, Joe knowing about what happened behind the source wall, and Jessica talking about, hey, Parallax is dead, without any evidence. It's like, here's stuff that, you know, again, Guy knows. And anybody was spending time in the Book of Oa, you would think, and you think Guy would have shared this, especially after the Starbreaker Supremacy thing. But the idea that, it's some of this stuff just makes me want to shake my head. Because now we have, the entities are automatically reborn somehow, but yet the other entities somehow manifested a knockoff fear entity. So now, this is not the original fear entity, but now that fear entity is going to keep rebooting. So that means if Parallax does somehow actually die, that means he's going to reboot too. So besides all the other Parallaxes that are still floating around in some way, shape, or form, we have the Timu Parallax, who seemingly you can't kill. And you have the real Parallax that you can't kill because he'll keep coming back. So I don't quite understand how they're going to... It just seems like another thing that wasn't particularly well thought out, unless there's going to be some master story coming down the road where like all these fear entities are going to finally combine into one. But it's another thing that kind of like makes you like scratch your head, like you're supposed to forget like it ever happened, kind of like that extra power battery in Oa.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention, Sinestro. When we see Sinestro and they're calling him and saying proceed to the hangar, where he's sitting, he's on the ledge overlooking the chapel, so he's keeping an eye on Guy at a distance.
That makes sense.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is I would have liked it if after the hangar door closed, when he walked into the meeting with Joe and Jessica, that he would immediately dissolve that robe and go back into his costume. Or when there are two opportunities to do this, when he basically says, you know, all right, here's the plan, here's where we're going, here's why we're going, and Yara, you know, teleports them away. I wish one of those two spots, he should have changed back into his uniform, because he doesn't believe it. So if he doesn't believe it, then he shouldn't be wearing this thing, because if he's doing it to put on an act.
But I think that's maybe what we're supposed to question, how much, I mean, even if there's a large part of him that consciously believes, yeah, I just got to play the role of this, there may be even if it's 20-30% of him that really does believe it, or doesn't have a choice because he may think he's doing it out of obligation but he's really doing it because of the power inside him is driving him. The power of Alpha compels you. That he might lose the uniform at some point. I mean, maybe when they're fighting the Manhunters, speaking of which, I still want to see this explanation. I still want to see how, I mean, it's bad. I mean, you can get away with it with green, I guess, because it's even though I guess they use yellow energy, didn't they? When Cyborg Superman was running them, did they run off of yellow energy then? Because if not, then it makes no damn sense whatsoever that the Manhunters would be able to channel any other part of the spectrum, because they're not living creatures, so they would feel no emotion anyway.
Well, I mean, I think they were running off of yellow energy because Sinestro had him on his side.
I mean, I think so too. Because Cyborg Superman was on kind of like Manhunter Prime at that time. Yeah. But still, I want to see if we get any kind of logical explanation for why or how they're able to tap into compassion. But
yeah. Too. Also, I think it's weird that of the team he brought, the people he took with him off the ship to go to Biot to confront potentially Manhunters was Razor and Yara, and he left Aya behind. He left the AI behind.
unless he was leery about maybe she could be taken
maybe.
Over.
Maybe. Yeah.
But then again, he shouldn't have taken her then.
The only other thing I'll say very briefly, because it's not going to warrant much of a discussion, is when John and Katma have their conversation and she says, "Do you even care what I want?" We have the bubble from John's ring saying basically his mother going, "Damn." Just to remind us that she's there. What was that for?
Exactly what you said.
Yeah.
That's another plot point it's probably going to go nowhere until somebody decides, hey, we have to do some weird storyline where they've done so little. After, like I said, they ignored it for so long, and since they have stopped ignoring it, it's almost worse. On some level.
And, you know, you mentioned it in your recap, the Razor Aya thing. Come with me, my love, and so we need to see a conversation and a thing between them too. Are we also only going to get a page of it? Are we never going to get it? Are we just doing this to keep them together, to remind us, just, oh, don't forget, Razor and I are still a thing. We'll get to it eventually, the same way we're doing it with John's mother in the ring. We're just going to drop a little breadcrumb there. Remind you, hey, this thing's still here. Well, just so it makes more sense when we circle back to it later. But don't forget.
It's probably, in all honesty, it's probably something similar to that, but it's probably a placeholder because of the fact that we know if anyone's going to do anything with it, it would have to be Jeremy. So, yeah, that's one of the weird things about this, too, These characters are all in the Morgan Hampton book when they really, if anything, are Jeremy Adams characters, and they should be in the Jeremy Adams book. But since they're shifting away from even Hal and arguably they're focusing on Kyle for as long as that's going to happen, he seemingly doesn't have room to do the Aya and Razor thing, which of course goes back to the point on why bother introducing that subplot if you're not going to have any time to pay it off. Why don't you just wait?
That's all I got for this. I mean, just to be perfect, yeah, there are things in here to nitpick about, and just as we just did, and things to be legitimately confused or upset about, but I mean, it's progressing at the very least. It's doing interesting things. Sora is back. I know Phil over over at Podcast of Oa with Myron, Phil's anytime I listen to a new episode of Podcast of Oa, it's about 75% chance Phil's going to bring up Sora. So, and how we should be seeing her at some point. So I know Phil's going to be excited. So good to see Sora. Hopefully that goes somewhere. It's good that the conversation with Katma finally happened. It's good that we're doing some stuff with these entities now. Like, I have to admit I was entertained by this issue, even if there were things that irritated me. So.
Oh, no, it's that's why, you know, that's why this issue in this book, I should say specifically, that's why this book is the better book so far, because there are still some problems with the stories here. And there's still some telling that's showing, excuse me. But overall, the book is still good. And at least it's dealing with some interesting stuff, which for the most part is more than we can say for what's been going on in the main book.
For sure. All right. Anything else for Core 14?
No, I think that sums it up.
All right. What's next?
All right. So a few things under the What Has Mark Seen banner. Not much. I saw Dolly a few weeks ago. I wanted to see the Elvis concert movie, and I'm still bitter that I took one for the team not to go see that. So that might prejudice my view on Dolly a little, which is probably, as far as a by the numbers horror movie with a slight, I can't even call it a twist, but it's just a different approach, different kind of killer, I suppose. It's okay. It's not anything anybody would ever need to see in a theater. It's or rent any. That's a freebie. Did see Undertone last week. That was last week's movie. I know a lot of people have been going gaga over this movie. I think Undertone's okay. I mean, I think the acting is good. I mean, the main actress really had to carry the movie because she, other than her mother, that those are the only two characters that really have any significant physical screen time. Almost everybody else is just their voice. So she's really good in it. And obviously the movie cost almost nothing to make. But I also think it's pretty slow. I mean, I fought to stay awake at one point, and I failed later on in the movie. And then when it finally gets going, which is like in the last 20 minutes, I don't know how satisfying that is either. It kind of seems almost a little bit too much by the numbers, but it's worth watching. I just don't think I don't think you need to go pay for it, unless your audio system at home is borderline passable, because since it's all dependent on how you listen to the audio and what you pick up on, that obviously the better audio system. So maybe on that level, maybe it'd be worth seeing in the theater, but I would say probably wait for that too. And that's all I got.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything. I saw TMNT 2 for the Fathom Events thing, but not much to say about that. Obviously I've seen that movie before. It was just good to see it in theaters. Project Hail Mary this coming weekend, tomorrow for you.
Yes, this is true. Before we move on to our final major topic, we don't want to forget about sales. That's probably what I should have rattled off, though I don't think I would have been able to do it based on the our self-imposed time frame. So this ever so briefly, the main issues we care about, for some miracle reason, which I guess tells you the Green Lantern KO was an interesting read for most people, that Green Lantern Galactic Slam one-shot was actually number 33. That's kind of shocking, but it is, which also raises the bar a lot for Green Lantern 600. Because if Green Lantern 600 can't beat these Galactic Slam, we got a problem. Green Lantern Corps number 12 was 114, which is a really big jump because it went from 141 to 114. No dyslexia there. That is legit. So it moved up. That was a significant increase. And Green Lantern, number 31 moved to 125 from 128. So it moved up a little bit, but nothing of consequence. Absolute Green Lantern, that moved back to number 21 after dropping to number 25. So it's still a top 25 book, but obviously it is several months in a row now. It's been selling outside the top 20. So I guess there's some softening of Absolute Green Lantern, even if it's not through the entire wave or line of Absolute books, at least Green Lantern has weakened a little bit. So the other Green Lantern books could just dream of being anywhere in the neighborhood of this, not even counting that stupid one-shot that, I mean, any ongoing book would kill to be anywhere like in the top 30 to 40 at this point. So the fact that the Absolute is still pretty consistently, you know, always in the top 25, that's up to now, that's still pretty good for that.
Yeah, people are talking it up online. Anytime a new issue comes out, there are people really adamantly excited for it. I honestly, I have not read a single issue since, other than what we have covered on the show. Anything that we haven't covered, I have still yet to read.
I actually read the last issue, whichever one it is, the 12. I think it was 12. I just read that tonight, actually. I mean, I had to, because I had to go back and double check if I thought I downloaded it when I downloaded this issue. But I knew I didn't read it because I never even had unzipped it yet. But I read it today. This was a slightly better issue. At least they gave Hal something positive to do as opposed to being negative. But it's still a lot of mumbo jumbo. But I do think this issue was a little more of an uptick and a little more easily accessible in minimizing the Abin Sur and Tomar this and Anomaly that. It still has those elements because I don't think he can help himself at this point, Ewing, but it was a slightly better read. I would just say that.
No, it's almost impossible not to be spoiled. So I've seen the splash. I know what happens to Hal.
Yeah. But. So that was nice. And actually even the end with Joe meeting, it's hard to say meeting Tomar, since Tomar is now another generic term, but meeting Tomar Ray as opposed to Tomar Joe. Oh God, just shoot me. But overall, it's a slight step in the right direction. But again, I don't think there's enough possible steps left to ever get that book in a true right direction where I would enjoy it.
All right. What's next?
I suppose we probably should talk about the Spider-Man Brand New Day trailer, which, did indeed drop today. We knew it was dropping. I mean, the rumors had been out there for a while. It was going to come out because they want to attach it to Project Hail Mary. But we knew officially on Tuesday it was going to be released on Wednesday morning. So what did you think?
I thought it was good. I don't pay attention to the
to the leaks or anything unless something particularly interesting crosses my feed that piques my interest. Otherwise, it just sort of, I mean, in this day and age, leaks and rumors about any given project, whether it's a movie or TV series, is commonplace now. So you're so used to seeing bullshit and just, you know, people making wild speculation that it's hard to, you know, unless you're actively paying attention to things, it's relatively hard to sort truth from fiction. So whenever I see those things in my timeline, I just kind of keep scrolling like anything else. So like, it doesn't really affect me unless I'm particularly intrigued by, like, obviously if someone says like Venom, I'm like, oh, okay. What? Huh? But you know, otherwise I don't really tend to follow that stuff. So I didn't know about, you know, the potential mutation stuff and yeah, unless you might have mentioned it in passing, when Brand New Day came up, in past episodes, but you know, interesting to me. I know there's a really popular story of Peter mutating and the whole man spider thing and all that stuff that people like in the Spider-Man in storylines and all the references. And I sent you a screenshot of various Spidey covers over the years being recreated in live action. That was pretty cool. I honestly, while it looked intriguing, while I'm curious to know what happens with MJ and Ned and his relationships and all this stuff, and I'm curious about the individual reaction between him and the Punisher and him literally just calling him Frank, and his, you know, him taking classes from freaking Bruce Banner, and so on and so forth. Something is just, when I watch this trailer, I don't have any idea how this fits into the MCU moving forward. I have zero idea how this is supposed to puzzle piece slot into the continuing story of the MCU. I'm utterly baffled. That doesn't mean anything bad. It doesn't mean anything good. It's just that with, it felt like with the trailers or at least with the other films or whatever, you could sort of, you like, you know, we knew we were going in a multiverse direction. So the fact that we would get other Spideys and previous villains and stuff is like, okay, that slots into the multiverse thing. And then the death of Tony Stark and how that affects him and so on and so forth there. And him, you know, trying to, you know, him inheriting, you know, the glasses and everything from Tony in the second one. And then just him being a fanboy and, you know, all this stuff with, you know, just a regular sort of friendly neighborhood Spider-Man story for the most part in the first film. Like, it served its purpose. And, you know, we saw his early origins. This, I get no sense of where this is supposed to, like, how this continues the story. And like I said, that's neither good nor bad. It's just I'm a little confused about what this movie is in the grand scheme of things outside of a Spidey story.
That might not be anything we're ever going to understand until after we get past Secret Wars and whatever reboot they're going to do. I mean, it may not have much of an, it's kind of hard to imagine it's going to have any kind of short-term significant impact, no matter what the status quo is when this movie ends for Peter Parker in his personal life, because, you know, this movie is taking place before Doomsday, which by all accounts, and it's going to thus taking place before Secret War, since we assume Doomsday is going to end with the destruction of the multiverse as we know it. And just one thing left, at least that's heading into Secret Wars. I don't know. It's one of those things. It's kind of like the dealing with Peter, how they dealt with it in Far From Home, because Peter got snapped away. Obviously, I think Ned got snapped away. Or actually, I'm trying to remember if MJ got snapped away too. For some reason, I think they did. They almost had to, because that one kid that was hitting on MJ was like 3 or 4 years behind them, or 5 years behind them, and all of a sudden he was the same age as them.
Yeah.
But it might be something like that. You know, I think it's been confirmed there's a 4-year gap now between the last movie and this movie, which is where a lot of those comic book recreation scenes are going to come from, by all accounts. That it's, there's going to be like a montage of him fighting a lot of lesser tier, but still well known. If you're a Spider-Man fan,
basically what they did in Fantastic Four, that
yeah,
montage.
Yeah. What they did to a certain extent in Fantastic Four. But it'll be cooler, obviously, because they're going out of their way to recreate, you know, pretty well, some well, really well-known covers. And I thought that was cool with the tarantula one for 134. 134 is a pretty...
Boomerang or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which is interesting because first, that's not what I thought they were doing. I thought they were just trying to ape that Spider-Man number one with from McFarlane. Mm-hmm. And so because I didn't even notice Boomerang at first. And then when you actually look at it again, it's like, oh yeah, Boomerang's on the bottom. So, but... Yeah, and the Amazing Fantasy 15, the Tarantula, which of course is also appropriate because that was the second appearance of the Punisher, 134.
In the Amazing Fantasy 16?
15, yeah. I enjoyed the trailer overall. If you have been paying attention to what this movie is supposed to be about and what allegedly is going on in this movie. Plot-wise, for the most part, especially just dealing with the stuff with what's going on with Peter, there was nothing in this trailer that either shoots that to hell or surprises you, because it kind of does reinforce things that you had heard that Peter is going to have to deal with or he's struggling with, and partially why he's struggling with it versus it appears that the majority of what he's throwing everything that he has into being Spider-Man because his personal life is a complete disaster and it's depressing and there's nothing that makes him happy at all in his personal life for the most part. His real happiness is coming from being Spider-Man. But there's always a problem. There's always a cost for that, suppressing a part of who you are. And I think that's supposed to factor into this too. The Bruce Banner stuff, I find it interesting, but not surprising that so many people's first reaction is like, oh yeah, he doesn't remember Peter either. Arguably, he's never known who Peter was because they've never had 1 minute of screen time together. Mm-hmm. They've never had one conversation. The only way he would ever know who Peter was would have been, and we don't even know this either, if there was some interaction between Banner and Peter Parker post the funeral of Tony Stark, which again, if that happened, again, we've never seen it. Or if during the 5-year gap after the snap, the blip, well, still the snap, because the blip, I think the blip is more, to me, the blip is always when they came back. But either way, that during the 5-year period between Infinity War and the bulk of Endgame, unless Bruce Banner and Tony Stark had been having regular communications and Tony mentioned Peter being, you know, to Bruce Banner. Other than that, and we have no evidence that took place either, because we don't really know. I think we kind of got the impression that Tony was pretty secluded from everybody for those 5 years. That other than that, there's no logical reason he would ever know who Peter Parker was, because Spider-Man first appeared when he was off in space, as he humorously pointed out in the beginning of Infinity War, whichever character he said first, I don't remember, but he said, there's an Ant-Man and a Spider-Man now, because all this stuff happened when he was off world. And he never interacted with Spider-Man at all. He never had any conversations with him. It's probably less that he forgot who Peter Parker was, as in that he was Spider-Man, that he never knew that Peter Parker was Spider-Man. He could have, but like I said, this is an off-screen conversation or occurrence if it ever happened. I thought the first 2 minutes of the trailer I liked more than the end. I didn't like so much the end, the stuff with the hand, because I don't really care about that crap. I don't. I mean, because I don't care about Daredevil. I don't care about Daredevil. I don't watch that. And to me, Spider-Man fighting the hand is not exactly an overly, I know there's a lot of them, but that doesn't exactly impress me as a villain you should be wasting your time having Spider-Man fight. I know we still have the Scorpion in this. Tombstone is in this, even though we don't really see Tombstone. I mean, as in physically seeing Tombstone's face or anything. But I thought overall it was good. I liked the tone they were going with. I liked the transformation stuff. I'm down for that. Depending where it ends up and how it gets resolved, I really would not want him to have organic webbing permanently. I mean, I don't know if we're going to end up there. Permanently, if it's temporary, I can live with it. I do think it's interesting that in a way that what they're trying to do in this movie is they're trying to merge the professional as Spider-Man problems that Tobey Maguire Spider-Man was dealing with the personal problems that Andrew Garfield Spider-Man was constantly wrestling with. So it's kind of like Tom Holland Spider-Man in a way has inherited a little bit of both of their problems in some kind of amalgam. But he's fantastic in the role. I mean, I think he is the best, because Toby probably was the best Peter Parker before there was Tom Holland, and Andrew Garfield arguably was a better Spider-Man, but not as good as Peter Parker. But Tom Holland probably is the best at being both, because he kind of covers all the angles. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be good. And I do like the style in this movie gives me hope, even though, because this is being directed by the director of Shang-Chi, not what's his face who directed the previous three. So I think this is, I'm intrigued by this enough. So it's certainly this trailer didn't disappoint.
No, I think it gave people what they were looking for the most part, because I didn't see people necessarily disappointed in this trailer other than those who were just shitting on it. Because I saw oddly enough, and maybe it's not because, you know, of the amount of people we follow on social media, specifically on Twitter, who are also into Green Lantern. But I saw a lot of the narrative about, like, oh, look how dark this trailer is, and like, you know, in terms of color and so on and so forth. And yet the people praising this trailer have a problem with the Lanterns trailer. And I was like, that's a it's really not a fair comparison, but also completely irrelevant point. They're two very separate projects. So that's the only negativity I saw about this trailer. It seemed like otherwise people were really excited by it.
Yeah, and you know, people always try to nitpick. As like, I saw somebody nitpick as like, hey, this is supposed to take 4 years later. Then how come the video that they're talking, that MJ and Ned are in, says it's their first day at MIT? Because obviously, rocket scientist, he's why. Either this takes place early on in the movie before we get before the jump to where we are now, maybe like the montage, or this is Peter just kind of like dwelling/obsessing, understandably so, about what he's lost, and he just constantly rewatches these old videos. It's pretty, again, that's not, it's not a, people look for plot holes when they're, you know, until something becomes a plot hole, it isn't. It's like, that's something that's pretty easy to explain why somebody could be watching a video that was from their first day at MIT, even though that's 4 years ago now, or eventually it ends up being 4 years ago. John Watts is the guy who, for some reason, I zoned out about, who directed the last three Spider-Man movies. Yeah, I think it's true Peter Parker, though, because of the fact that he can't catch a break, you know, especially from a personal life perspective. Sometimes a Spider-Man, it can catch a break. Not that much, but more than he does as Peter Parker usually. But the idea that, hey, okay, Spider-Man is kind of being, and it makes sense if Spider-Man is being, for the most part, now embraced as a hero, and people love, and generally speaking, people love Spider-Man. And people don't know who Peter Parker is. The people who did know don't know who he is. Obviously, some people now know who Peter Parker is, because it's not like it's a permanent spell and everybody who meets Peter Parker forgets him again in 24 hours. That's not the way the spell worked. That it makes sense that he would throw himself completely into the one thing that he feels that he does well, and he gets some kind of satisfaction, even if it's temporary, out of, even though that's not. But you do feel bad for him because of everything that he gave up in order to, you know, the ultimate taking one for the team there.
Yeah, agreed. Otherwise, yeah. I mean, I thought it was good. Looking forward to the film. I also, by the way, I did see some people like trying to already pit Supergirl versus Spider-Man in terms of which one they're excited for and which one sucks and so on and so forth. I'm like, I'm excited for both, guys. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting older. Maybe I've just been in this. I've quote unquote been in this game. I'm too old for this stuff. I've been in this game so long with all the speculation and fan arguments and so on and so forth. I'm just sick of it. But I'm honestly just like, can we just wait till the movie comes out and then shit on it or heap praise on it? Can we let go of all this bullshit?
And again, I mean, it makes you wonder if the people who are doing it are either against Snyder sycophants, or just anybody who are anti-James Gunn people, just because of the fact that, I mean, realistically speaking, it would be stunning if, from a financial perspective, if Supergirl came anywhere close to what Spider-Man's going to make. So if you're looking for an apples-to-apples comparison to begin with, Spider-Man is clearly the favorite for the one that's going to, you know, be the bigger box office champion of the two because of the pedigree. And Spider-Man's one of the most popular characters, period, let alone, and then you're comparing it to Supergirl, that's nowhere near one of the top DC characters overall. So, and even if that universe had been established as being really big, it still would be. But yes, there's plenty of room for both, because Spider-Man comes out right at the very, very end of July. But I find it interesting somewhat that in short fashion, how, at least temporarily, how Doomsday has kind of like completely fallen off the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Which may be a good thing, maybe a bad thing. Like, I mean, so it certainly alleviates your fears that we were never going to get any break from the drumbeat for Doomsday once it started. And obviously we have, because Doomsday has kind of become an afterthought between the Dune trailer coming out and then followed quickly by the Spider-Man trailer. And it makes sense. Spider-Man should be the main focus because A, he's the most popular character. B, if there's one thing they have left in them that's a sure thing, it should be Spider-Man. And the fact that it comes out first. I mean, Doomsday doesn't come out to December. You got plenty of time. You got Comic-Con. You got Comic-Con to push Doomsday if you want. It makes plenty of sense. But I do find it interesting. And it does raise the bar a little because of that so many people like the Dune trailer. I mean, I don't think Dune is inherently anywhere close to as popular as the MCU has been. But at least Dune is heading in the right direction. You know, Dune is kind of peaking. It's kind of like, you know, the second movie kind of built upon the first, as far as from an interest perspective. So there's going to be a greater interest going into three logically, while the MCU has kind of been stumbling. I mean, their TV shows have been kind of working out a little bit better lately. And if Spider-Man's a big hit, you know, Wonder Man, what may not have been a huge hit. I mean, from a ratings perspective, I don't think it was, but people seem to like it. I believe the Vision show is going to come out somewhere between Spider-Man and Doomsday. Now, they certainly have a chance to be rolling into Doomsday on at least a decent win streak. So, but Spider-Man, and obviously if Spider-Man is fantastic, that's only going to help Doomsday. It's only if Spider-Man is not fantastic and people are disappointed in it that you have to worry. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting how Doomsday is just boom, 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 boom. It's kind of like cricket chirps, that it's just kind of completely fallen off as it's been drowned out by one project, you know, whether it's appropriately Freudian Project Hail Mary coming out now, and then the build up towards, you know, the superhero movies and other things that are going to be coming out in the next few months, that I just thought it was interesting that even I found less of an interest in. I haven't been clicking on nearly as many of the videos about different things regarding, this leak and that leak. It's like, I haven't even had much of an interest to even watch any of the videos, because I'm kind of done right now with the rumors, because there's so many of them, and I think I want to see the trailer first before I kind of, that probably will invigorate me depending on what the trailer's like.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you. We just got to wait and see what happens.
We should have, I'm going to guess in the next couple of months, we're going to have a trailer. I have to go back and see what stuff comes out in May, or which when the next big Disney movie comes out, past, I would say at this point, probably either the end of April through the beginning of June or something. That's when you would suspect we'll get one trailer. I mean, it would be the stupidest decision of all time not to have some Doomsday trailer on Spider-Man when it comes out at the end of July. But I don't think they're going to necessarily wait until July to give us a first a first real trailer, not these little character pieces or puzzle pieces or whatever the hell the Russos want to call them. That to get an actual full-on teaser trailer, I would be surprised if they're waiting that late in the game to do it. But I'll be curious when we get it. But right now, I think it might actually be in their best interest to just kind of let it quiet down and let the other things come and go, let the momentum for that stuff builds up, and then they can go full court press. Especially once Spider-Man is in the rearview mirror, that's the thing for them at that point.
It'll be a busy summer for us. You and me. GL June, Supergirl, Spider-Man, then Lanterns.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of stuff that's coming out one way or the other. And there's other movies along the way, too. But yeah, it will be. And then obviously, once we get to the fall, there's going to be a lot of stuff, too. December is going to be pretty packed, assuming. And it certainly appears that Dune is not going to move. And maybe there'll be, who knows, maybe they'll be right. Maybe there'll be surprisingly a lot of momentum for Dune, where, yeah, it's not going to beat Avengers Doomsday. And it would almost be impossible for that to make more money, certainly worldwide, than Avengers Doomsday. But it does have all the IMAX theaters. I don't think Doomsday's playing at all in IMAX. I know Secret Wars will, but But Doomsday, pretty much, it all those IMAX screens are going to Dune 3. So they seem to be pretty content on just rolling the dice on that one, and whatever happens, happens. And I mean, it is the right time of year to have. It is the right time of year to know that you're going to get business. They must. And again, and maybe it's a little easier doing it on projects like that, because, you know, it's not like you're opening this movie, you know, having a chance to have the, you know, biggest opening weekend of all time. So when you know that's not the case, it's probably easier to just say, we'll play the long game with this. We know there's interest in this. We're heading into Christmas and winter break and Christmas break for people, semester break from college, that there's going to be plenty of time for people to go see our movie. So whether they see it the first weekend or they see it 3 or 4 days later, when they have time on their hands, we feel confident people are going to go see it. So they're willing to kind of take the much weaker opening weekend box office that they would have had if they had opened up against much weaker competition, but they're willing to roll the dice on that because they're confident in their movie. So we have to respect that if they, you know, because it certainly does not appear that they're going to move. And yeah, it'll be interesting. That doesn't really happen that often when you have two things going against each other for the same audience nowadays. But you could also understand why they didn't move, because they had that date first, because it was Doomsday that moved. Doomsday was supposed to come out in May of this year, and they moved it back to December. So they really should never have been a head-to-head battle between these two movies until Marvel made it that way. So
yeah. Other than that, I think that's going to do it for this episode, right?
I would agree. And next week is Green Lantern 600, right?
Yeah, Green Lantern 600, and I guess Project Hail Mary talks.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
So we are all set up. So if people want to reach out to us and let us know what they thought about this issue of Core, the new Spider-Man Brand New Day trailer, what do they do?
Can visit the website, lanterncast.com. Can email us at lanterncast@gmail.com. Can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, X, Facebook. Use hashtag Geocast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. And last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.